For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Very happy that we are joined by Steve Weintraub. Steve is a senior teacher at San Francisco Zen Center. Was a student of Suzuki Roshi, ordained by Richard Baker Roshi. Also has been a practicing psychotherapist for a long time and is going to talk today about Zen and psychotherapy. He's also the official liaison of San Francisco Zen Center to affiliate groups, San Francisco Zen Center groups like Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. And also, Steve and I go back. My first practice period at Tassajara, fall of 83, that's more than 30 years ago. Jeez. Anyway, we were living next to each other, and Steve and his wife Linda, who's now the abbess of Green Gulch, and Sarah was, I don't know if she was two or one, I think maybe less.
She was two and a half.
She was two and a half then? Yeah. And
Tygon gave her a ceramic frog, and from then on it was known as the breakable frog, and for, she still has it, and it hasn't broken.
Oh my God.
The breakable frog has not broken.
That's wonderful.
It's still good.
It's still good, yes. So anyway, I'm very happy that you're here, Steve, so please we'll have some time for discussion at the end, and a more informal discussion after with tea and cookies after that. But
great.
Good. Please.
Yes. Thank you very much, Tygon, and it's really a pleasure to be here. Let me see if I can see you all better if I put my glasses on. They're for reading, but maybe that will work. Let's see here. No, it doesn't make much difference. It doesn't make much difference. Anyway, it's a real pleasure to be here. And as Tygon said, we go back a long way, and it's a joy to me to see the growth and flowering and development, the flowering of the life force of Zen in the United States, and more specifically of Suzuki Roshi's lineage. And that's with the affiliate sanghas that just for the last few months I've had this job of being the liaison to two affiliate sanghas. It's various affiliates within the Suzuki Roshi lineage in the United States. And Tygon and Ancient Dragon Zen Gate certainly represent one of the most significant developments in this flowering of Zen practice. So I think it's very, very helpful and really good to be here. So so as Tygon mentioned, I've been practicing as a psychotherapist since 1990. Come on in. So that's 23 years, 2010. Yeah, 23 years or so doing that. The first 7 of those years, I also worked in community mental health in San Francisco. So working in community mental health, as those of you, somebody I met earlier said they were a social worker, therapist, and others of you may also have worked in those kind of public situations. And as you know, that's a situation where you work with people who often are severely disturbed, incapacitated, have severe mental, emotional, psychological issues, and also are usually at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. But most of my practice has been in private practice in San Francisco, seeing a wide variety of people, individuals. I haven't been working so much actually at all with couples or families, but in individual therapy. So I think the subtitle of the talk today, Zen and Psychotherapy, is Resonance and Complementarity. And those are the two, especially the resonance part, those two things, and especially the resonance, is what I want to emphasize this afternoon. But I'm sure that we'll also get to what are significant differences between them. Before getting into that material, I thought I would say something autobiographically. My Zen and psychotherapeutic autobiography, as it were. I am just turned 66 years old. When I was a teenager, which would have been shortly after the Paleolithic era ended, in the 1960s, I would characterize my internal state as confused, upset, disturbed, depressed, not good. And I'll say more about that as one of these essential resonance elements. But just autobiographically, I could say that I was ripe for psychotherapy. I was ripe for, that is, as a patient, as a client, I was ripe for Zen practice. And both actually were significant. I had already been in psychotherapy as a young teenager. I had suggested it to my parents. This was 1960, when I was 13. In 1960, it was not a usual thing to go to psychotherapy, and it was especially not a usual thing to have your 13-year-old son suggest such a thing. But so I did that for a number of years. All I remember of that psychotherapeutic experience was my doctor. He was a psychiatrist, as all therapists were at that time. I remember he used to play with his pipe a lot. He would tap it out, put stuff in as I was talking, you know? And I had a lot to say. I would just talk. And I don't remember if he ever said anything. I'm sure he said something, you know, but not very much other than the pipe activity. Dr. Farber, I think his name was. I've thought of looking him up in my adulthood, but never got back to it. That was in New York. So, fast forward a few years until I was 18, 19, 20, read Alan Watts, and through a series of accidents, kind of accidents, with some intentionality involved as well, I wound up as a 21-year-old in San Francisco, having hitchhiked across the country in record time, because the people I hitchhiked with were amphetamine drove very quickly. I didn't use any of the amphetamines, but anyway, wound up in San Francisco and more or less immediately started practicing Zen with Suzuki Roshi at Sokoji Temple. So this was a wonderful, fortuitous turn in my life. I'm recollecting Jung's statement He's very good at these one-line statements where this one is, the right way to wholeness is made up of wrong turnings and fateful detours. So I took a left turn at New York and detoured to San Francisco and have been there since. And the living presence of Suzuki Roshi, even though I wasn't that close with him, but nevertheless, seeing the embodiment of practice, of Zen practice, was the main inspiration for my continuing and continues to this day to be the primary inspiration for my practice. I had a very, or another way to say it, this is an extremely useful, positive, idealizing transference. And there's a well-known psychologist, Buddhist practitioner, maybe you know her, Taigen, Polly Eisendrath Young.
I've heard the name.
Yeah. Anyway, she talks about the unobjectionable idealizing transference. And this is actually, it's a bunch of lingo, but it actually makes sense. It means that you see someone and you see their, it's like, wow, that's, I'd like to be like that. And that's certainly the way I felt about Suzuki Roshi and how some of you may have an idealizing transference with the main teacher here, much as he tries to dissuade you. But it's unobjectionable. It's actually useful. It's actually, in her formulation, it's giving the enlightenment, the awakening. You give it to someone else, the Buddha nature. Oh, that person has realized Buddha nature. And then there's a slow process, if things go well, of owning it oneself. Just like they say in psychology, you bring the projection back. You own the projection. This is a wonderful part of Zen practice. I practiced Zen, and though I think I'd be hard put to say exactly how or why, it clearly answered the Sturm und Drang, the upset, the difficulty. It was a response to the disturbance that was such a significant part of my life, a stable, helpful response to that via Suzuki Roshi's example and via his teaching. He died in December of 1971, and his successor, for some of you this is all, you know all of this stuff, his successor was an American person, Richard Baker. We used to call him Baker Roshi. And I continued, so as I said, the last 23 years or so I've been practicing psychotherapy. The 2 years before that, I was going to school and getting a degree that enabled me to practice psychotherapy, and the 16 or 17 years before that, I was an ordained Zen person and my life energy was totally focused on Zen practice and also San Francisco Zen Center as an institution, and at that time it was developing very strongly as an institution. And I was kind of in the middle of it. So then, 12 years later, when did you come, Taigen?
I showed up in the middle of 78 after having practiced several years in New York.
I see. So 5 years after Tigan came and 12 years after Richard Baker assumed the leadership of Zen Center, again, some of you may know there was a big scandal, there was a big to-do, a big tumult that not atypically, that involved Richard Baker as the leader of this organization, who we all really had a very strong idealizing transference with, and it was crashed, for some of us, crashed on the rocks of this scandal, which, as scandals often do, involved sex and money. I was the president of Zen Center at that time, so I was kind of right in the middle of it in a bad way. So it really shook me up. And one of the things that helped enormously at that time, that provided a kind of enlightenment experience, turned out to not be sitting on the cushion, as I had done at that time. By that time, I had probably spent, I don't know, 10,000 hours sitting on a cushion, a lot of time. There was a span in there when Reb Anderson, who was not a full teacher then, but had some teaching responsibilities, he decided we should have a 7-day sesshin every other month. So we did that for a number of years, and I joined those. Anyway, there was a lot of sitting. But the enlightenment experience that I had in the spring of 1983, I think that's it, came from reading a book by a psychoanalyst, namely Adolf Guggenbuehl Craig's book called Power in the Helping Professions. And what had hitherto been very inexplicable to me, how could the Zen master, who is an enlightened person, how could he do this stuff that was so wrong, that was so harmful? And there was nothing in the Zen world that really explained that. But this Swiss guy with the strange last name, Adolf Guggenbuehl Craig, he explained it in a way that was very potent. It seemed very clear. He talked about how in any situation of unequal authority, unequal power, a shadow is set up. This is the other side of the idealizing transference, and needs to be dealt with very carefully, especially for us Americans, for various reasons that I can get into. But anyway, he clarified that when there is that power differential, in addition to all of the positive stuff, a shadow can be created and all kinds of trouble can come out of that shadow unless it's taken care of, unless it's looked at and dealt with and worked with. And I think I would say now that Richard Baker really didn't have the means to do that at that time, and none of us did either, those of us around him. That was a major motivating feature in my stopping working for San Francisco Zen Center, which I did a couple of years later, and entering my own psychotherapy as a patient, and then a couple of years after that, going back to university and getting a degree that allowed me to practice psychotherapy. So this thing of Zen and psychotherapy is very, it's not just a theoretical thing for me, it's very central to the actual course my life has taken. And then for a number of years, I think the psychotherapeutic, it felt to me like this. The Zen thing was here, and my wife, Linda, who's now the abbess at Green Gulch Farm, she was kind of thoroughly pursuing that, and the psychotherapy part was kind of, it was just hard for me to bring them together. And then after a while, they kind of came together much more. So that brings me to the present, to this notion of resonance and complementarity. There's one other thing I was going to say. So that's maybe an autobiographical framing of what I have to say, and then a historical framing of it I want to address also. And here I feel very much Taigen, who's very deeply knowledgeable about such things. So if I say the wrong thing, if I get it wrong, please tell me, okay?
Okay, I'll interrupt. If I need to.
But from my sense of it, if we look at, so this is a large framing statement about Zen and psychotherapy. So if we look at Buddhism from India, so Buddhism has moved historically, always moving from India, started to China, and then from China to Tibet, to Korea, to Japan, and also from India to Southeast Asia, and then various other combinations as well, but always moving from one place to another, and now has in some significant beginning way, jumped the Pacific Ocean and moved to the United States, and also, of course, to Europe, and so on. As Buddhism moves from one place to another, I think it would be fair to say that it historically has the local culture and the local religion of wherever Buddhism moves to has always played a very important part in what the new Buddhism of that place looks like. So Zen is a very good example because I think the case could be made that Zen is not exactly Buddhism. It's not the Buddhism of the Indian originators and of the Abhidharma Buddhist practitioners. Zen is very much Indian Buddhism in the context of Chinese culture, specifically Chinese Taoism and to some degree Confucianism as well. And because that was such a predominant cultural model, that is the Taoist and the Confucian model, that also tended to be what it looked like in some of these other places also. So for an example, what in Indian Buddhism might have been considered Bodhi. So Bodhi means awakening, enlightenment, realization. By the time it got to China, well, not by the time, but 500 years or 1,000 years after it got to China, the Chinese, as we know from the Tang Dynasty Zen teachers, the Chinese Zen masters didn't so much talk about Bodhi. They spoke about the way, as in Nansen and Joshu's famous conversation. Joshu asked Nansen, "What is the way?" Nansen said, "Everyday mind is the way." That's also very significant in terms of psychotherapeutic understanding, which hopefully I'll get to. Anyway, and then the conversation went on, but just lots of interesting things there. But just that first statement, what is the way? He didn't say, what is Bodhi? He didn't say, what is the realization? So the very word that in India meant the absolute top of the heap, you know, where you're trying to get to, was called the way, the Tao, which is Taoism, not Buddhism, you know? So similarly, just as... am I talking too loud?
No.
My wife's not talking so loud. Talk so loud.
It's just fun.
I'm getting excited. I'm stopped talking loud. So just as... Buddhism has changed and was seriously influenced by Taoism and Confucianism, my theory is that it will be strongly influenced in the United States, maybe even more so than in Europe, but certainly in the United States, it will be strongly influenced by our local culture and our local religion, known as science, known as Western psychological understanding, known as feminism, known as democracy, known as possibly social, you know. I know Tygen is very strongly involved in environmental work and the work of social justice and peace work. Those are, that's our local stuff. That's the stuff that we've got. That's going to get mixed in a lot with Zen practice. That's my prediction, and I suggest that we return in 500 years and find out. Because that's about how long it takes. Usually, well, you know, things are going faster now with the internet. Maybe it will only take 400 years instead of 500. It takes a while for it to happen. But if history is any example, then it will happen. So that's the wider framing of what I understand, and I'm joking about the not really joking about the 500 years, but this conversation that we're having today, and many, 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 many more over years and decades about these things, will elucidate and draw out, well, how are these things related, and what do we make of that, and how does one influence the other, and so on, like that. So I think of this today as being a part of that kind of context. Okay, so those are my framing comments, and then what I wanted to speak about is resonance, and then specifically resonance in three areas between Zen and psychotherapy. This is my outline, I'm telling you in advance. So etymological, which is just is interesting and fun, turning towards suffering, which I referred to earlier, and I'll elucidate a little bit more. Within that, valuing suffering. And next is the way I phrase it is, what's the problem and how do we address it? What's the difficulty and what's the response to it? The resonance between Zen and psychotherapy in that realm. Those are the three areas of resonance that I would start with. And then I want to also speak somewhat about complementarity. How, in my perspective, having done that, having had them come together in my own life, how I see the richness. It's not exclusive, it's not like it's got to be this way, but the tremendous richness of bringing both things to the table, bringing both things to the study of our own life and working with others as well. Okay. So etymology, psychotherapy, psyche, therapy. Psyche, I can't remember if that's the Greek or the Roman name for the goddess of the goddess called Psyche, but has become, you know, our psyche refers to, in the most general way, our entire inner life. All of our thoughts, feelings, memories, motivations. This is our psyche. As opposed to our soma, right? As opposed to the body. Our psyche. Therapy means to attend. So a friend who for some unknown reason, knows enough ancient Greek to have read the Iliad and the Odyssey in its original, tells me that the people who helped, the kind of squires who helped Odysseus and, you know, Agamemnon and all, they were called therapon. They were attendants, you know. So they were the ones, you know, who would, you know, sharpen the spears and do all of this stuff for the knights, you know. They were the therapon, the attendants of the knights. So to attend the psyche is what psychotherapy is about. I think it's a very beautiful and kind of deep, simple explanation of what happens in psychotherapy. It's got a lot of different names, you know, there's a zillion different psychotherapies. And maybe some of them don't focus on attending the psyche, but the ones that I'm interested in, depth psychotherapy, Jungian, Freudian, lots of different contemporary psychoanalytic schools, on and on and on, and attachment theory, all has to do with attending the inner contents of, in the dyad, of the person sitting across from you, of the patient, of the therapist. That's the fundamental action of it. And in fact, I would even go so far as to say that's the fundamental therapeutic element. That's the fundamental thing, that the fundamental healing element is attending. That often has immediately lots of other ramifications, but the fundamental aspect of attending the psyche is curative, I would say, healing. Not exactly curative, like no problem, but healing. So, some years ago, Linda and I went to, being, you know, Northern California people, we went to Calistoga to take the mud. There's special mud in Calistoga, and you take all your clothes off and sink into the mud for a while and then shower and do various things. And so we went in and so on, and then we were introduced to, well, here's Mary, she'll be your mud therapist. So our mud therapist attended us as we were sitting there with the mud, you know, up to here. You're lying, you're not sitting, you're lying down, and the mud's covering your entire body. And if you move, it gets hotter, so you don't want to move too much, you know. It's already pretty hot. And she was just there, you know, patting our thing and forehead, giving us cold drinks to drink, you know. It's very much like a psychotherapist. Yes, I know you're in the mud. It's very hot. It's very hot. Here's a cold drink. Let me pat the sweat off your brow. Metaphorically, I think there's something to be said for it. And then just a little bit further, not only this, that it means attend the psyche, a couple things. One is, so what is the quality of attend? I think the quality of psychotherapeutic attending is, I'm positing this, and later when we have a discussion, you can tell me if you feel differently about it, but I think the fundamental quality of that kind of attending is, on the one hand, not denying, not avoiding, not, in a sense, participating with a person's own defensive responses to their experience, which sometimes entail avoidance and denial and all kinds of, no, 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 I don't want to look at that. Gently encouraging a turning toward those things. So that's one part of the attending. And then another part of the attending is not being overwhelmed by the experience, by the karma, by what the person is emotionally experiencing or what their history is, not being grabbed, gripped, stopped, held by that. So, hey, this sounds a lot like Zazen to me, you know, not rejecting and not being caught by is, very roughly, one could say, not a bad description of our attitude in sitting, in shikantaza, you know, or opening the hand of thought, as Uchiyama Roshi would express it. So this is the quality of psychotherapeutic attending of the other person, I believe. Not only that, but if you go past the whatever that psyche word is, Greek or Latin, you can go to a further root. And you can go to Sukhe, which is the, not surprisingly, and I'm trying to say it that way, that many words come from, what is that called? Onomatopoetic, right? It sounds like the thing it is. Sukhe means breath. So psychotherapy, it turns out, means attend the breath. So I kind of felt like, well, gee, that's fun, you know, for us Zen practitioners, you know. We sort of know something about that, or at least have experienced something about that, about attending the breath. So that's that side. Jumping to the other side, to the Zen side, the Buddhist side. So the root of Buddhism, Buddha, Bodhi, is B-U-D-D, Bud. And B-U-D-D means to wake up, awake. So if we were to call our endeavor by its English name, rather than it's a Sanskrit, you know, B-U-D-D is a Sanskrit root. If we were to call it by its English name, rather than its Sanskrit name, we'd call it awakeism, wake-up-ism. That's what we're trying to practice. So what are we waking up to? What does that mean, wake up? Wake up to what? Where have we been asleep? And just in this sense of resonance, there again, there's many ways to talk about that, what we're waking up to, but in this resonant way, I want to point to the very first teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha, the very first mythic teaching, and I do take his life story as myth rather than as historical fact. I was just thinking in that connection earlier of Taigen's book, Bodhisattva Archetypes, that we can see the archetypal nature, this isn't, I don't think, in your book specifically, but we can see the archetypal nature of the life story of Shakyamuni Buddha as our own life story. So I take it as important that since this myth was created, that what was shown as the first teaching, which is the you know, after Buddha attained enlightenment, he then went back to the deer park and taught the ascetics that he had been practicing with. And what he taught them was the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So the Four Noble Truths is a kind of diagnosis of what the problem is. And the last of the Four Noble Truths is the path, the way, how to respond to what is true in our life that is difficult. And the first part, the first of the Eightfold Path, the eight parts of the of Marga, of the path, is view. So this is all to say that right there, in the very first teachings, very, very central to Buddhist understanding is our view, namely, how we see things. Namely, our psychology. That is our psychology, is how we see the world. There's a well-known, or somewhat known, case number 12 in the Shoyoroku, where this Zen teacher asks this person who's just arrived, where you come from? Oh, I come from the South. And then the teacher says, well, how's Buddhism doing in the South? This is a paraphrase, not exactly right. And he says something like, well, there's a great deal of discussion going on. I think that's such a wonderful line. You know, you get that you in quality. They're gabbing away about Zen and stuff in the South. And the Zen master, whose name I've forgotten, do you recall who it was?
I'm not sure.
Anyway, he says, how could that compare with me planting the fields and eating rice? And then the student says something like, well, you know, that's the way the world is. And then the master says, what do you call the world? So I think that's that same thing of What do you call the world? What does it look like? If you're depressed, it looks very different. He didn't say this, the Zen master. If you're depressed, it looks very different than if you're not depressed. If you have a fixed idea about what a terrible person I am, it looks very different than if you don't have that fixed idea. What do you call the world? What is the psychology that you approach the world with? So, from the point of view of etymology, my sense is that psychology is very Buddhological and Buddhism is very psychological. That there's a significant degree of interplay, even in the words themselves and what they mean. Going on to one of the places where this is most obvious is that they both begin with dukkha, which is the Sanskrit word meaning suffering. In fact, that is the first of the Four Noble Truths, as you all know, is the noble truth of what we in English call suffering. Maybe better translated as unsatisfactoriness, the way things don't work well. A very quick, I can't resist, etymological note here about dukkha. Dukkha means literally, or from its roots, it means broken axle. And what it refers to, even more specifically, that, you know, an axle, like, you know, with wheels, right? What it refers to more specifically is that the hole in the wheel is not in the center. So if you imagine an axle where the hole is not in the center, that's what our life is like. That's what we're, you know, bazunka, bazunka, bazunka. It doesn't roll along smoothly. Things don't happen the way we want them to, the way they should happen. This is dukkha. And so this is the first of the Four Noble Truths, and this is what Shakyamuni Buddha said, I teach only dukkha, only suffering, only how things are unsatisfactory, and I think the word he used was cessation, and the cessation of dukkha. I would say it somewhat more modestly, and the alleviation of dukkha. Mm-hmm. I teach only suffering and the alleviation of suffering. That's what Buddhism, that's what our practice is. That's not the only thing that happens in practice, but that's like central bedrock, essence of what our practice is there to address. And again, in my own life, and very well may be in your life as well, that was certainly the initial and for a long time ongoing energy for motivating me, impetus for practice. So I teach only dukkha, and so they both start with dukkha, and of course, and more or less it goes without saying that on the psychotherapeutic side, the Western psychological side, of course no one walks in the door of the psychotherapist's office because they're really doing great and there's no problems. And, you know, actually very rarely someone will present that way. They'll come in and tell me how everything is really great, you know. And then I know I'm really in for some trouble. You know, because that really must be some deep suffering to present it that way. Let's see, what else was I going to say about this thing? So, about this aspect. So they both begin with suffering, and they both turn towards suffering. Oh yeah, that was another thing I was going to say, is one of the ways that these are resonant is that in both cases, I think for some of us, this is a tremendous relief in our culture, because our culture is so devoted, single-mindedly devoted, to avoiding, denying, minimizing, eradicating, flushing down the toilet, telling you how in three easy steps you don't need to suffer anymore. All you need to do is, you know, get a nip and a tuck and a this and a that and get the right eyeshadow and, you know, buy the right car and so on and so forth. So for somebody to say, the first truth is suffering, is difficulty, is that things don't go the way they should. Things don't go well. How much of the time? 2%? 99.2%? somewhere in between there, you know. This is a tremendous relief for us in psychotherapy. I dare say I think I felt that even with Dr. Farber, even though who knows what I was talking about, but I think there was some of that when I was 13 years old with him. And there's some of that feeling also in practice, is the relief of the willingness to face toward it. And our practice and our psychotherapeutic practice in that way requires courage on our part as the ones, and encouragement, giving ourselves courage, giving us from our teachers and from our therapists and so on. That it's an encouragement. One could even say, I might even say, that Zen practice is fundamentally about encouragement, encouraging us in our life. There may be many elevated teachings and, you know, many, many different things to say, but their effect, if their effect is not our encouragement, then I don't know about it. Fundamentally, that's what we're doing. So, a little bit further about the suffering thing. So it's not just starting with suffering, turning towards suffering, but in both Zen and psychotherapy, I think there's a valuing, I guess that's what I was implying, it's just drawing it out a bit more. There is a valuing of suffering. Suffering is a valuable thing. Again, Jung said, the gods are in our symptoms. He said something like that. He had a way of encapsulating and condensing a lot of information in a short sentence like that. The gods, that is what it is that's valuable and meaningful and powerful in our life, they're manifesting now in our twitches and our anxieties and our whatever. But that is where that will come from. You know, this is very central to Alcoholics Anonymous and Jung's influence on Bill W., the founder. You know, the sense that the alcoholic's struggle was a spiritual struggle. It had to do with spirit, with psyche, with the soul. And to leap over to the Zen side, to one of our favorite guys, Dogen Zenji, the 13th century Zen master, the lineage from Suzuki Roshi, the lineage back to the 13th century, to Dogen. So Dogen, of whom Taigen is a real expert, in the Genjo Koan, if I am remembering correctly, and the work of his entitled Genjo Koan, he says this extraordinary thing, among many extraordinary things that he says. He says, those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. It's very classical, classic Dogen-esque way of saying things. But what I'm focusing on is those who have great realization of delusion. And in a sense, I'm morphing delusion and suffering a little bit. Still on this topic of the value of suffering. Dogen is saying, oh, delusion, very valuable. That's the most valuable thing, because it's of delusion that realization occurs. It's not get our usual idea of practice is you got to get rid of the delusion and then you get to the good stuff, the enlightenment, et cetera, which doesn't have any of this bad stuff in it, delusion. He's saying that is a very deep deluded idea. That's what he's saying. He's saying no. It is great realization of delusion. We need delusion. We have to have delusion in order to have great realization. Great realization is in delusion. Really, it's even deeper than that. It's non-separable from delusion. So this is a great valuing of our life, a great valuing of even the difficulties of our life, even the delusions of our life. Again, in maybe it's the Genjo Koan, someplace, he says, here is the place. Here the way unfolds. Here. 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 Not someplace else. It's that same thing. It's not after you leave this crummy life that you happen to have, you know, or this depressed life, or this anxious life, or this upset life. It's not after we leave that life that the way unfolds. The way unfolds here at this time. This is very basic, base rock Zen understanding. Dogen understanding, Suzuki Roshi understanding is you don't need to go anywhere else. Everything we need is here. So this is a tremendous valuing, and this is very Mahayana because it means you don't have to shave your head and wear black robes and go to the mountain and not talk to anybody for 16 years and face the wall. And it's not, that's one here, but this here is a here too. In the middle of Chicago, in town, having a job, getting tired, taking the subway. Do they have subways here? Yes. Taking the subway, getting caught in traffic, being angry with the person who's cutting you off on the freeway. Here the way unfolds. That here. So there's this great, I feel, resonance in both the aspect of suffering of this is where the path begins, the psychotherapeutic path begins, and the Zen path begins, and also where it ends, you might say, or the value of this. And, as I pass by it, again, in the psychotherapeutic realm, I've certainly had the experience, and I would imagine that those of you who are psychotherapists have also, which is that the end product of working with someone in a deep way, sometimes over a long period of time, is not some happy, oh, now I'm happy, you know, and I don't have any problems anymore. That's not what happens, you know. What happens is that the meaningfulness of a person's life and of a person's struggle becomes more, they can appreciate the meaningfulness of it. Just for one very quick example, a man that I've worked with in psychotherapy for quite a few years, many things going on for this person, but one thing that he told me about when we first started working was his road rage. And I don't know which highways he was on, but whatever they were on, whatever he was on, he would have innumerable instances of some goddamn blah, 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 cutting him off. And I'm not going to let that happen to me. And he'd roll down the window, you know, and thank goodness he wasn't in Los Angeles where they carry guns when they have fights about that kind of stuff. So he'd be yelling and shouting and screaming and so on and so forth. Fast forward X number of years, 5, 8, 10 years later, actually it was probably more like 5, and he came to realize that what was actually happening there was a deep feeling for him of helplessness in the face of the world, the world's treatment of him. And this had, not surprisingly, very deep roots and very in real traumatic experience for him as a child, as the child of parents who were divorced and whose divorce was very acrimonious, and they used him and his brother, and yeah, it was terrible stuff. But anyway, so just as here is the way, here the place unfolds, just as our work in Zen is transformation, maybe too fancy a word, but I'll put it in there just for the moment, is to transform our life. Similarly, his road rage was transformed into a deep appreciation of his own sense of helplessness, which the road rage disappeared. It didn't make any sense anymore to him. So that's an example of this valuing of suffering and transformation of it, I guess, one could say. So, we were just going to meet until 4:30, and I also wanted to speak about the problem. The problem and how to respond to it, and complementarity. In order for us to have a discussion, I will try to contain myself and abbreviate those comments. Thank you. So, and I was a little concerned about this thing of the problem and the response to it, because I feel like I feel what I'm saying very strongly, but it may sound rather, I don't know what, esoteric or intellectual or something like that. So be forewarned, it may sound that way. But I think, I hope, it's rooted in our actual practice. So fundamental to Buddhist understanding is, there's a poet, Jane Hirschfield, an old friend of yours too, Taigen, wonderful woman, who was there in the 70s and 80s at San Francisco Zen Center. Thank you. And somebody asked her, you know, well, if you boil it all down, you know, could you just give us Buddhism in a few easy pieces, you know, a few sound bites? And she said, sure. Everything changes. Everything is connected. Pay attention. So everything changes. So ontologically, that's my big multi-syllabic word that I'm bringing in here today. Ontologically, Buddhism understands that everything is changing, and that nothing has an inherent self, which on the one side means it's connected to everything else, and on the other side means it's empty. Those are the same thing. Pratityasamutpada equals shunyata. Emptiness means everything is connected. Everything is connected means things are empty of their own individual self. I'm not going to explain that today. So, that's our ontology. That's the way things are. Or as Suzuki Roshi used to say, what was his phrase? Things as it is. That's things as it is. So, the most useful, the most appropriate, the best attitude that we can approach this kind of ontology, where everything changes and nothing has its own independent nature, is an attitude, an approach where flexibility is emphasized, where we are open to that possibility. So a couple of things Suzuki Roshi, among many, 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 many things that he said, it is the readiness of the mind that is wisdom. Wisdom is not some thing, some state, some piece of information, or pieces of information. Oh, I have 92 pieces of information, and these are what they are, and that means wisdom. Wisdom is not something like that. Wisdom is being ready. That ready refers to a world that is constantly in flux, that we are participating in and are by no means in control of. He said, it is the readiness of the mind that is wisdom. He said, enlightenment is to forget this moment and grow into the next. It's that same thing. Enlightenment is not some thing, some state, some way of thinking about things or anything like that. It's more like an attitude of forgetting this moment and growing into the next. In other words, meeting reality as it changes. And it will change from moment to moment, especially if we're paying attention. We will notice how much it changes. And then soon, sooner than we'd like, we'll stop breathing and stop living. That's a big change, you know? And it's coming down the road. That's one of the main ones that, you know, catches us as human beings. We don't like that one. We don't like that particular change, you know, usually. So, the problem is, I'm kind of doing it by reflecting its opposite. The problem is when we're not flexible, not open, not adaptable, not when we're stuck, when we're caught, the caughtness and stuckness. Suzuki Roshi often spoke about, don't have a stuck idea. You know? The caughtness and stuckness means the inability to move, to shift, to be with how things are. Because we're, no, I'm this way, you know. So very briefly, that's the Buddhistic side. On the psychotherapeutic side, one of the modalities of analytic psychotherapy that I enjoy and appreciate and hopefully manifests itself in my own psychotherapeutic practice is a contemporary psychoanalytic school which has the terrible name Control Mastery. Has anybody ever heard of this, Control Mastery? Mm-hmm. It's called the San Francisco... They came up with a better name for it. Because I'm not interested in control, and mastery is a fool's game. So I think Control Mastery is a terrible name, but their actual ideas are very good, or I find them very useful. And they now call it the San Francisco SFPRG, San Francisco Psychotherapy Research Group. Anyway, they have something that's very familiar, you know, that goes back to Freud and comes out in many other ways. The way they express it is that as children or as infants, when we're growing up, we have formative experiences that form us. And they form us because we don't have a lot of other experience to judge it against. And we come up with beliefs from our actual experience. So if I cry and my mom responds by saying, "What are you crying about? Quit crying." Then I learn that crying is bad, or that my own discomfort is to be denigrated and despised. And 30 or 40 years down the road, you know, that person that I just described walks into the psychotherapist's office and tells the therapist about numerous terrible experiences that they've had in relationship. Why? Because they have a fixed belief. They don't call it that in psychotherapy. Actually, the name that they use in the Control Mastery School is pathogenic. Suffering. Genic is origins. The origins of that person's, the pathogenic belief is, you know, I'm not supposed to assert myself. I'm not supposed to have needs. If I have needs, people important to me will be harmed. Therefore, I choose not harming them because I love them. And instead of me harming them, I'll simply not have any needs. And this is these are the kind of eddies, like we think of our life as flowing, these are the kind of eddies, the kind of stuck places that we work with as psychotherapists. Again, I'm using this particular language, and there are various ways of describing it. But so I think that, again, just briefly, hopefully bringing out this point, that the resonance between the psychotherapeutic approach and the Buddhist approach is that both of them work with stuckness, stuck ideas, things that don't move, things that are not wide enough, ideas that are not wide enough to encompass the current reality. You know how they say, you know, no, I'm not your mother, you know? That's because the person thinks, is treating you like you were their mother. That's not the current reality. The current reality is very different than that, but for very understandable, legitimate reasons, biochemically and otherwise, we're stuck with these old ideas. So the work of practice and the work of psychotherapy is softening them up, loosening them up. In the psychotherapy research group language, they say that the purpose of psychotherapy is to disconfirm pathogenic beliefs. That's all you have to do. Of course, if you just say no, you're not guilty, even though you feel that way, they mean emotionally and more widely and deeply disconfirming them, not just intellectually, although it may sometimes even simple statements can have profound effects. So, in a sense, this disconfirming of pathogenic beliefs means that it has to do with this kind of stuck quality, this kind of, another word for that is habitual. Those are fixed ideas that we have. And our practice also works with fixed ideas. You know, one of the main fixed ideas we have is that I'm me and you're you, right? And that those don't meet is a fixed idea. We work with that. I am really going to shut up in just a minute here. So how do we work with it? I'm not going to even go to the complementarity thing. Oh, yes, I will, just briefly. So how do we work with it? We work with it to go back, you know, we work with it. It's complicated, many things to say. But one way we could say that we work with this in our practice is not suppressing our thinking and not indulging in our thinking, attending our thinking. Not suppressing our fixed ideas, not indulging in our fixed ideas. The reason we don't try to eradicate our fixed ideas is because eradicating, as Bankei said to his student in the 17th century, the student said, constantly wild thoughts are arising for me. How do I eradicate them? And Bankei said, to think of eradicating a wild thought is a wild thought. So the idea of eradicating is sort of trying to use the poison as though it were medicine or something like that. Anyway, it doesn't work. So that's why we open the hand of thought and we don't engage in our thinking and we don't deny our thinking. This is called, in the Fukan Zazengi, think, not thinking, non-thinking. That's the practice. One way to talk about it. And something similar happens in psychotherapy. Complementarity, very quickly. I think one of the main complementarities I already alluded to, which is that in this environment, in 21st century United States, we damn better understand Western psychological things like power shadow dynamics, like narcissism, like personality disorders, or else we get into a whole heap of trouble and it keeps happening, you know, especially, you know, gender, male power, a female in a less powerful position. There's a whole thing kicked up recently with Sasaki Roshi in wherever he is in the Southwest, of a similar nature. And another thing like that is how we can confuse, these are called near enemies, how we can confuse a Western psychological malady for a Buddhist virtue. For example, compulsive caregiving, bodhisattva vow. I think there are some people who think they're practicing the bodhisattva vow, but it sure looks like compulsive caregiving to me, you know. Oh, you go first. I don't need anything. Certainly, I'll it's all yours. So Darlene Kalm, who's no longer alive, a wonderful Zen teacher, she practiced for a number of years when they would pass around a tray of cookies. She always chose the largest cookie. That one. As a way of working with this. Okay, I'm going to stop. And I'm sorry to have not allowed more time, but let's see what you all have to say about any of this, and we'll continue. Yes.
So, thank you, Steve. Comments, questions, responses?
Yes, please.
We have quite a few therapists in the room. Jim.
I really like a lot of things that you said, but I would kind of respond to pretty much the last thing that's on my mind. That sometimes in order to see those things, let's say my compulsive caregiving, for example, I need someone outside me to notice it. And that, I think, is one of the things that a therapist can do that doesn't happen just from your own meditation. It's someone else's to recognize.
Absolutely. And I think also, and I'm interested to hear your sense of this, Taigen, but I think that I believe, a mistaken idea of the Zen practitioner as being this person. The main thing they do is sit on a cushion and look at the wall. But the three treasures are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Not just Dharma, not just the practice. But Buddha also, which also means relationship with the teacher. And this is a tricky area, but I think one of the teacher's job is to say, oh, did you notice that? How about that? You know, that kind of thing in a skillful way. And then Sangha is very important, and you feel it a lot when you're living with people 24/7. You get a lot of feedback, you know, about where you might be off. But I think your point is well taken, is that we need help in widening our view sufficiently to see where we may be off base and that kind of thing.
Just briefly, one of the differences between Zen Center and what we do here, we don't live together. So we come together and different people come different times, and there's a large number of people who might show up at any given event. I try and encourage discussion, and I also have many people who give talks besides myself. So the Sangha thing, I think, is very important. Maybe I don't set myself up enough as a transference object, but I don't want to be that. Trying to have community. We have a very wonderful large group of many talented people, so I think we have a strength in Sangha, but it's very different because we come together in this, at a storefront. So I don't know if other people have comments on that, but I don't know if we live up to what I think of as Northern Californian Jungian Buddhism, but I appreciated your comments, and I'm interested in hearing others.
Yeah.
Yes. I am not a psychotherapist. I'm a psychotherapy patient. I'm just curious as to something I've been thinking about is how to reconcile this idea of facing suffering with, I'm a medicated psychotherapy patient. I have an anxiety disorder which requires, at this point, 3 milligrams of clonazepam per day, or else I start having massive anxiety attacks. And when I am on the correct dosages of medication, Zazen works the way it's supposed to. But when I'm not, like, it doesn't do what it does for people with ordinary brain chemistry. And I'm wondering, like, how to reconcile those ideas of you need to face suffering, but
yes,
at the same time, you know, you need a certain level of relief from suffering in order to be able to face it in the first place.
Well, I have...
Steve, please.
Yeah, thank you. I have a really specific and clear notion about that, which has to do with what's called skillful means. So, again, in the teaching, which is very skillful indeed, there's wisdom, there's the way, but the notion is that as important as wisdom, maybe more important, is how it is skillfully communicated. So the originating mythic story is that when Shakyamuni spoke to the French people, he spoke French. And when he spoke to the German people, he spoke German. And when he spoke to, you know, anyway, some version like that. And I also have a poem that I composed about skillful means. And the poem is, "Wisdom ain't worth a hill of beans unless you've got skillful means." So, this is all to the effect that we have to approach these things skillfully. And that's what I hear you doing, actually, very much so. Is, well, how do I face my suffering? If you tried to face it without the lorazepam?
Clonazepam.
If you tried to face it without that, it would just be too overwhelming. Well, what's the point of that? That's not gonna go anywhere. That's not gonna help, you know. So actually it's quite skillful to create the right degree of a suffering. Similar kind of a thing. Back in the 70s, I think we felt like, you know, sitting zazen, you know, put a bowl full of marbles on your head and don't drop any of the marbles, you know, absolute stillness. But I don't think that's very skillful. It's skillful if you're obsessive compulsive. Or if you're trying to prove something, if you're trying to prove how tough you are, some baloney like that. But I don't think that's actually what the point is. It's not, you know, where you're seeking to be in the most difficult situation possible in order to somehow get something out of that. There's some flaw there. So I think it needs to be very carefully taken care of. And that's often an individual by individual,
yes,
kind of perspective.
Yeah, I think we used to have some idea that whoever sits in the most difficult position for the longest without moving is the most enlightened.
That's right.
The good old days of Macho Zen, you know.
Macho Zen, exactly.
So, yeah, how do we be kind, you know, and actually help? Yeah, other comments, questions, responses? Deborah?
I think of the two parallels, I think, with psychotherapy and Buddhism are the concept of compassion and empathy. Maybe they're really the same thing. When we can adopt that with ourselves and with others, how transformative that is. And I'm not sure if we can adopt it until we've been able to experience it from another person,
mm-hmm,
in a deep kind of way.
Yeah, I think that's very... I appreciate that point very much. And I think this last thing that you said, unless you can experience it, because I think in both the psychotherapeutic endeavor and the Zen endeavor, book learning, which is not experiencing it or reading about it on Wikipedia, they can be useful, actually. They can be skillful. They can be skillful means for expanding, developing one's own sense of things, and I'm just joking by denigrating them, but it actually takes people, human beings, and another human being who's physically there, not on a screen. Zen Center is actually considering this thing called the fourth practice center, which is the internet. And I'm not so sure about it. I'm not so sure. I am sure. In fact, we were going to invite Taigen to teach some classes that then people could podcast into or whatever that's called, you know, and do stuff. And it may have very good uses, but there's something very important about that person to person thing. And on the empathy thing, a really beautiful work of Dogen's is called Ta-Nehisi's translation is The Four Methods of Guidance. Mm-hmm. And the four methods of guidance are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and the fourth one is called identity action. Now, you may know this better than I do, and you may know the Chinese better than I do, but I was kind of thinking, gee, identity action sounds a heck of a lot like empathy to me. It means identifying, does it or doesn't?
Well, yeah, no, I think that's one way to talk about it. Cleary translates it as cooperation, and that's also part of it.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. So anyway, these are the four methods of guidance. Do you recall Okamura's translation of that? He calls it something a little bit different, not just guidance, but...
Four bodhisattvas...
Embracing actions. Embracing actions.
Yes, that's it.
So these are four embracements. And the fourth embracement is a resonance between people, mm-hmm. speaking of resonance.
Yes.
Just touching on this idea of empathy and compassion, and you're speaking about this kind of, I forget the term you used, but this kind of valuing, coming to value suffering in its own right for what it is. And I think in the Buddhist sort of frame, the part of the reason that becomes valuable because it serves as a kind of springboard or basis for this identity action that you're talking about. In other words, it enables the unfolding of compassion, not just, you know, in the practitioner. And I'm wondering, could you say anything? Is there any corresponding kind of idea in psychotherapy for the person who's receiving the psychotherapy and how it opens them up or whatever?
Thank you. Good question. This may be an area where we can see at least a superficial and perhaps a deep divergence between psychotherapy and Buddhism and Zen practice, because in a sense our practice is more and more as we practice is a devotion to the benefit of others, whereas when we're in psychotherapy, purportedly, we're trying to benefit this thing called myself, you know, because of my own suffering. But I'm chuckling, and I say purportedly, because I think inevitably, it's really clear to me, if I think of people that I've worked with over a period of time in psychotherapy, they become more highly attuned to and more empathic and bigger, deeper people than they were in a certain way when they first walked in the door. And it's not stated as a goal. It's not, you don't say that. You don't say, oh, well, come and pay me a lot of money over the next 10 or 15 years and you'll be a better person. You talk about alleviating suffering, you know. So it's a little bit different, but I don't know that the difference is that is really a deep difference. So was that addressing what you were
saying? Yes.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, thank you.
Good.
It seems like that is maybe sort of related to ways in which I think we can sometimes get caught up in trying to use Zen as a means of self-improvement too, that we try to, you know, I'm going to become a better person or I'm going to become more generous or something, and it can be such a dangerous trap, because on the one hand, it seems like that does come out of practice sometimes, but it can't
yes.
be the goal. It's
That's
like
right.
it's like ordinary
something?
Mind, like
yeah.
directing yourself towards it.
That's right.
You're going to get stuck somewhere.
Yes. Yeah, I've forgotten your name.
Oh, Asian.
Asian is referring to a little bit further in this dialogue that I quoted earlier, because when Joshu asks Nansen, what is the way? Nansen says, everyday mind is the way. And the next thing Joshu says is, can I approach it directly? And Nansen says, if you approach it directly, you're going in the opposite direction. That's a little, if we approach it as one more self-help. And sometimes people think that that's what Zen is, you know, it's one more program of self-improvement or that kind of thing. And if that gets them in the door and they sit down, you know, Katagiri Roshi's five-word Zazen instruction was, sit down and shut up. If it gets them in the door and they sit down and shut up for a long enough time, that's fine, they can think that. But it's not exactly that way. It's not a self-improvement program. It's not one more thing like that, like what's on the magazine covers, you know, about how to, you know.
But you know, I say sometimes that Suzuki Roshi way, we talk a lot about non-gaining attitude.
Yes.
And that's true, and that if you have some idea of something you want to get, that's, you know, counterproductive. It doesn't, you know, that's not going to be it. And yet, if you sit a while, we know Zazen's transformative. It is, and there are benefits to it. Not necessarily, you know, not just to ourselves, or you know, but something happens. And also, it's not just to say that it's about that there's. Talk about non-gaining attitude doesn't mean, some people think that means that it's kind of meaningless or purposeless, and that's not true.
Right.
It's meaningful. Yes. That's, you know, you talked about your story about suffering as a teenager. For me, I was looking for something meaningful to do, you know.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I always have to modify that non-gaining attitude. And I think that's also a resonance with psychology.
Yeah. Except I would say in the psychotherapeutic realm, it's a little bit more, it's more under, it's usually not explicitly stated, more implicit, less explicitly stated perhaps. And I think that's what I was trying to get at also, what I was saying.
I have a question. I, coming at it from the point of view of the psychotherapist, sometimes, as well as someone who is attempting to develop a Zazen practice, I find that as my therapeutic practice grows, that I have more difficulty sitting Zazen. And sometimes it feels to me like when I'm in a therapy session, that there is something about that that feels very much like Zazen. You know, but that at the end of that time, I need to move. You know, or that there's a sense of I need the counterpart, I need movement in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing more yoga lately. But it's so the question is in terms of the process, you know, it makes me wonder if some of the same, well, you're saying that today, but it feels that way too sometimes when you're trying to pay close attention and be quiet and be still.
Yes.
To be able to do that. It does feel sometimes like that is that you're doing Zazen.
Absolutely. Well, I think there's you know, and in our practice we play around a lot with there is something called Zazen where you sit on a cushion or some other way and you cross your legs and you know so on and so forth. There is that physical thing. But in another way, Zen mind is Zazen. And that Zen mind doesn't just happen. We hope it just doesn't. It doesn't just happen while you're sitting on a cushion and with your legs crossed. No, it's a very wonderful thing to happen in a psychotherapeutic situation, while you're driving, while you're talking to your husband, having a fight with your husband or wife or daughter or grandfather or whoever, friend. So that, very much Suzuki Roshi's way is Zazen and everyday life. And what that means is our goal, I don't know if it's goal exactly, but the direction of our effort is not just something that happens in one place on Tuesdays at 6 o'clock in the morning, but actually permeates our life. So...